I looked at the young SHOs, and to my embarrassment could not remember any of their names. When I became a consultant 25 years ago, the department had just 2 SHOs. Now there are 8. In the past, I used to get to know them all as individuals and take a personal interest in their careers, but now they come and go as quickly as the patients. I asked one of them to describe the scan on the wall in front of us, apologizing for not knowing who she was. "Alzheimer's," one of the less deferential registrars shouted from the darkness at the back of the room. The SHO told me that she was called Emily. "This is a CTA of the brain," she said. "Yes, we can all see that, but what does it show?" There was an awkward silence. After a while, I took pity on her. I walked up to the wall and pointed to the scan. I explained how the arteries to the brain were like the branches of a tree, narrowing as they spread outwards. I pointed to a little swelling, a deadly berry, coming off one of the cerebral arteries, and looked inquiringly at Emily. "Is it an aneurysm?" Emily asked. "A right middle cerebral artery aneurysm," I replied. I explained how the woman's headaches had in fact been quite mild, and the aneurysm was coincidental and had been discovered by chance. It had nothing to do with her headaches. "Who's doing the exam next?" I asked, turning to look at the row of specialist registrars, who all have to take a nationally organized exam in neurosurgery as they reach the end of their training. I try to grill them regularly in preparation for it. "It's an unruptured aneurysm, 7 millimetres in size," Fiona, the most experienced of the registrars, said. "So there's a 0.05% risk of rupture per year, according to the cooperative study. And if it ruptures, 15% of people die immediately and another 30% die within the next few weeks, usually from a further bleed, and then there's a compound interest rate of 4% per year." "Very good. You know the figures, but what should we do?" "Ask the radiologists if they can coil it." "I've done that. They say they can't." The interventional radiologists, the specialist X-ray doctors who now usually treat aneurysms, had told me that the aneurysm was the wrong shape and would have to be surgically clipped if it was to be treated. "You could operate, but should I?" "I don't know." She was right. I didn't know either. If we did nothing, the patient might eventually suffer a hemorrhage, which would probably cause a catastrophic stroke or kill her. But then she might die years away from something else, without the aneurysm ever having burst. She was perfectly well at the moment. The headaches for which she had had the scan were irrelevant and had got better. The aneurysm had been discovered by chance. If I operated, I could cause a stroke and wreck her. The risk of that would probably be about 4 or 5%. So the acute risk of operating was roughly similar to the lifetime risk of doing nothing. Yet if we did nothing, she would have to live with the knowledge that the aneurysm was sitting there in her brain and might kill her any moment. "So what should we do?" I asked. "Discuss it with her." I had first met the woman a few weeks earlier in my outpatient clinic. She had been referred by the GP, who had organized the brain scan, but his referral note told me nothing about her other than that she was 32 years old and had an unruptured aneurysm. She came on her own, smartly dressed, with a pair of sunglasses pushed back over her long dark hair. She sat down on the chair beside my desk in the dull outpatient room and put her elaborate designer bag down on the floor beside her chair. She looked anxiously at me. I apologized for keeping her waiting and hesitated before continuing. I did not want to start the interview by immediately asking her about her family circumstances or about herself. It would sound as though I was expecting her to die. I asked her about the headaches. So she told me about them, and also the fact that they were already better. They certainly sounded harmless in retrospect. If headaches have a serious cause, it is usually obvious from the nature of the headaches. The investigation organised by her GP, hoping perhaps that a normal brain scan would reassure her, had created an entirely new problem. And the woman, although no longer suffering with headaches, was now desperate with anxiety. She had been on the internet, inevitably, and now believed that she had a time bomb in her head which was about to explode any minute. She had been waiting several weeks to see me. I showed her the angiogram on the computer on the desk in front of us. I explained that the aneurysm was very small and might very well never burst. It was the large ones which were dangerous and definitely needed treating, I said. I told her that the risks of the operation were probably very much the same as the risk of her having a stroke from the aneurysm bursting. "Does it have to be an operation?" she asked. I told her that if she was to be treated, it would indeed have to be surgery. The problem was knowing whether to do it or not. "What are the risks of the operation?" She started to cry as I told her that there was a 4-5% chance she would die or be left disabled by the operation. "And if I don't have the operation," she asked through her tears, "well, you might manage to die from old age without the aneurysm having ever burst. They say you're one of the best neurosurgeons in the country," she said, with the naive faith that anxious patients use to try to lessen their fears. "Well, I'm not, but I'm certainly very experienced. All I can do is promise to do my best. I'm not denying that I'm completely responsible for what happens to you, but I'm afraid it's your decision as to whether to have the op or not. If I knew what to do, I promise I would tell you. What would you do if it was you?" I hesitated, but the fact of the matter was that by the age of 61, I was well past my best buy date, and I knew that I had already lived most of my life. Besides, the difference in our ages meant that I had fewer years of life ahead of me. So the lifetime risk of the aneurysm rupturing, if it is not operated on, would be much lower for me, and the relative risk of the operation correspondingly higher. "I would not have the aneurysm treated," I said, "although I would find it quite hard to forget about it." "I want the op," she said. "I don't want to live with this thing in my head," emphatically pointing at her head. "You don't have to decide now. Go home and talk things over with your family." "No, I've decided." I said nothing for a while. I was not at all sure she had really listened to what I had told her about the risks of surgery. I doubted if going over it all over again would achieve much. So we set off on the long trek along the hospital corridors to find my secretary's office and arrange a date for the operation. On a Sunday evening, 3 weeks later, I trudged into the hospital, as usual, to see her and the other patients due to have surgery the next day. I went to the hospital reluctantly, irritable and anxious. Much of the day having been overhung with the thought of having to see the woman and face her anxiety. Every Sunday evening, I cycle to the hospital full of foreboding. It is a feeling that seems to be generated merely by the transition from being at home to being at work, irrespective of the difficulty of the cases awaiting me. This evening visit is a ritual I have performed for many years, and yet, Try as I might, I cannot get used to it and escape the dread and preoccupation of Sunday afternoons. Almost a feeling of doom as I cycle along the quiet back streets. Once I have seen the patients, however, and spoken to them, and discussed with them what will happen to them next day, the fear leaves me, and I return home happily enough, ready for the next day's operating. I found her in one of the crowded bays on the women's ward. I had hoped her husband might be with her so that I could talk to them together, but she told me that he had already left as their children were at home. We talked